Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Get 16-ounce packs of flavorful Angus 90% lean ground sirloin for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then buy two, get two free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hey, welcome in, everybody, to another edition of All Rise, the podcast that features Diane Godfrey, the intrepid court reporter who has covered so many celebrated cases in her 30-year-plus career. Stories about the court system, crazy cases, bizarre criminals, attorneys, DAs, judges, and much more. I'm Boston broadcaster and podcaster Jordan Rich, Diane's sidekick, and I love being with her and listening to the stories along with you. And Diane, we have two great guests today, J.P. O'Donnell, a writer of detective novels, a children's book, and the author of Living on the Fringe of the Mob. Joe wrote the book on the behest of Steve Sachs, who tells his riveting story of growing up around the New York mob from the 1980s through the early 2000s. As you'll hear, Steve is connected to some of the highest-ranking and notorious mobsters in New York City by virtue of long-standing childhood friendships and legitimate business relationships. Steve is a successful entrepreneur in the meat products business. The book is terrific. Diane, I invite you to take it away.
Welcome to our special guest today, Joseph P. O'Donnell, who is a writer, and he wrote a terrific book, Told to Him. It's a story of Stephen Sachs. And the name of the book is Living on the Fringe of the Mob. And I have to tell you, they were kind enough to send me a copy, and I read it in one day. I got it, I read most of it, and the next day I read the last few pages. And I think I did that to another book when somebody was on, Jordan, with one of their books. But this was a terrific book, and it was a page-turner.
Oh, I was just going to say, page-turner is the name of the game. You could have listened to the book, too, by the way.
Well, yeah, because the famous Jordan Rich narrated the book.
Consider it a high mark in my career to do a book like that. It was a lot of fun.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you, Jordan. We're happy to have you do it.
We've got the author and the man who told him the story. So, Joe, we'll start with you to talk about how you came across Steve and why this made such a great story in your estimation.
Well, I was going out to play golf here at our club in West Palm Beach, Florida. And this guy came over to talk to me. I had seen him around, but I did not know him. And he said, I've been looking for you. And I looked back and I said, why are you looking for me? And he said, well, you're the guy that wrote a book and they made a movie out of it, right? And I said, yeah, that's correct. And I said, but I'm going out to play golf right now, so you want to get together and talk about the movie sometime, I'd be happy to do it. He said, no. He said, I want you to write my life story. And I said, I'm a fiction writer. I make stuff up. I don't write memoirs or biographies. He said, no, when you talk to me for a while, you're going to want to write my story. So I agreed to meet Steve about a week or so later in one of the card rooms here at our club. And I said, okay, give me an idea of why I would want to write your story. And he said, my childhood friends where I grew up in Brooklyn, New York, were the Columbos, the Gambinos, and the Bananos. And I knew these guys my whole life. And they went into crime. I went into my father's business. But I did favors for them the entire time. It kind of caught my attention. And he and I began meeting for breakfast, and again in some of the card rooms here when they were empty. And I interviewed Steve for a year and a half, twice a week for a year and a half to get his story. And I was fascinated by what he told me.
Joe went out and bought me a tape recorder. And truthfully, I don't have an iPhone. I still have a flip phone. All right? And people laugh about it. I'm not technically bright with this stuff. So Joe bought me a tape recorder, and I told a couple of stories on tape, but then I told stories on top of the stories. So the tape recording got wiped out. Okay? So we more or less accomplished things by going to the card room, the library, and talking about the different incidents that I had growing up in Brooklyn as the only Jewish kid in that neighborhood for a few miles. So that's how it began, and one thing led to another. Before long, besides the tape recorder, which he finally showed me how to work, I also wrote pages down of things that occurred during my childhood and then later on in life.
So that's how we got going on this project.
Right.
Steve, two quick things come to my mind as you're speaking. First of all, if Joe could tell the listeners which movie they made one of his books out of, because I know that he mentioned that and he must be listening. We don't want to go off on a tangent, but we'd like to inform the listeners of which movie it is. And
sure.
Secondly, the first thing I thought of, Steve, when I saw this book was, oh my goodness, weren't you scared? Like, I think I know the answer to why you had free rein to write the book. But you did have free rein to write the book, right?
Right.
With no
yes.
retribution. Because that would be, in my eyes, a touchy subject matter.
Yeah. Right. Well, as far as your first question, I was an unknown writer. I authored my first book called Fatal Gamble. It was about a private detective in Boston.
Uh-huh.
And it went really nowhere. Then I wrote a sequel because I was trying to find a literary agent that would pick up my work, and the agent convinced me that I had to write a second book in order to be considered a legitimate writer. So I wrote the second book that was a sequel to the first, and that was called Deadly Codes. And both books were about a private detective in Boston. And unbeknownst to me, my wife's cousin, who loved the books, lived in New York and gave them to a friend who lived in his condominium complex in New York City.
Uh-huh.
That guy was a two-bit character actor in plays and some movies.
Yeah.
And he read both books, loved them, and sent them to a guy in California. That guy eventually got them to Bobby Moresco, who won the Oscar for the movie Crash for Best Screenplay of the Year.
Mm-hmm.
Bobby called me and said, I love this story, and I love this character, and I think he's perfect for a film noir. And yes, they eventually made a film out of my book. It's called Bent, B-E-N-T, and it came out in 2018.
And it stars Carl Urban, Sophia Vergara,
and Andy Garcia.
So yeah. It's an A-list cast, no question.
Yeah, and they even gave me a cameo.
You know what? You told me that, and I did watch the movie, and I saw you sitting at that table with the beautiful woman in the nightclub scene.
Yes, but she could not speak English. She only spoke Italian.
Didn't matter to you, Joe. I know.
No, she was very pretty.
So getting back to Diane's second question, that was about Steve. You want to comment, Steve, on your story?
The question was whether I was afraid of writing the book itself.
You tick somebody
correct?
Off, but you know what? Can I tell you, as a reader of the book, you didn't say anything derogatory.
No,
you just
no.
told how life was back then with people
exactly.
you knew.
Exactly. Right. And about the meat industry being as corrupt as it was with many of the mafia guys involved. The meat industry was one of the most corrupt industries in the country. But growing up, first of all, afraid, no, because as Joe wrote the manuscript, I would take it and meet with an individual who's part of the Gambino family. And we'd sit down, talk about it, and we're friends. And I would say to him, do you feel that I should change names? And he said, no, absolutely not. Name them all. He says, I don't give a whatever. And I said, well, I'm going to change some of the names as we go. And as we finished the manuscript, a gentleman out of Brooklyn, and I do call him gentleman, moved down to Miami, and we stayed in touch. And I knew him for many years, part of the Bonanno family. And I ran the manuscript down to him. He loved it. Well, a few weeks later, Joe said to me, you know, Steve, the stories are great. We did a good job. He said, but what about the veracity of some of your stories? I mean, people are questioning, you know, do I know whether they're truthful or not? I said, I'll tell you what, Joe. I said, I'll make a luncheon date with the last man standing in the Bonanno family, okay, from Brooklyn. And we'll go down and you can ask him anything you want. And that's what we did. I took Joe down to Aventura. We sat for 3.5 hours at a beautiful Italian luncheon. And Joe asked whatever he wanted to. And my friend turned to him and said, anything that's in this book that I know about is true.
Correct. And I asked him if I had anything to worry about in writing this book with those names in it. And he said, don't worry, they're all gone. When Steve and I knew them, we were both in our 30s or early 40s. He said, there's no one left that's going to bother you.
That's interesting. So, yeah.
Yeah.
Truthfully, at 82 years old, I really don't care.
I've got to tell the audience, guys, that having also interviewed these two, Diane, on my own podcast, we got into a lot of issues, but one of them was some of the physicality that you exhibited. You were a strong, you still are, but you were a strong young guy who didn't take any guff and stood up to not just guys in the mob, but stood up to gangs.
The drug pushers. Yeah, that's correct. On 38th Street, where the plant was, 9th Avenue on the west side of Manhattan, there was a big drug problem. And one of the stories involves a priest or Monsignor who kind of called for a meeting of some of the business people on the west side of Manhattan in regard to kids being harassed with drug pushers along their way to parochial school. And how the mothers were worried and families were worried. And this particular priest called for a meeting. He called me up, and I had no idea this was occurring. I knew about the drug pushers because I had my own situation with them, which is also described in the book. And the priest called for a meeting, and when he called me up, I said, Father, I'm Jewish. Why are you bothering me? He said, well, a couple of the Italian people in the neighborhood said that you would be the type of individual that would stand up and try to take care of things out in the street with them. And we went to the meeting. It was at the Giovanni's on 40th Street and 9th Avenue. And Giordano's in a garden restaurant, and we sat and talked about the problem, and we agreed that we were going to go out in the streets and clean it up. And that's where I got involved with Manganeros, which is a very famous restaurant on 9th Avenue 38. It was the home of the six-foot hero, the original six-foot hero, Sal and Joe Manganaro. Then we had Vinny's Fruit Market, and Jimmy, the black gentleman from the nursery, he was like 6'2", 6'3", and built like a wall. And we went out in the streets and we cleaned it up.
I just want to say that the reason the Monsignor asked Steve and these other guys to help get rid of the drug pushers is that the cops were all being paid off.
That's right. 10th Precinct,
yes.
Not the Midtown South.
And he knew, he said, the mothers are coming to see me. They're crying. Their children are being ruined by these drugs and drug pushers. And Steve and these guys cleaned that area up and got rid of them.
You outlined that segment of the book beautifully. It was great.
I still have the baseball bat in the back trunk of my car. They wanted to bronze it.
Well, you know, the overarching theme through the book, you know what thought was running through my head the entire time? Steve must have been one tough son of a gun. And you know what? You did. You weren't like, you didn't have a chip on your shoulder. You didn't look for trouble.
Not at all.
But it was just the way the neighborhood was. But I'll tell you what, you had nerves of steel, I must say. You were like Rocky Marciano. I mean, and your mother would catch you up, but you were no worse for the wear, I'm telling you. It was hilarious. No. And I'm like, I have to see this guy. Is he big or, you
here
know?
I am, Doc. Here I am.
How tall are you?
I'm only 5'10". I shrunk.
Oh.
That's more than me.
I
so.
Was weighing about 220, and I went on a diet. I'm down to 194.
Still can handle yourself. One of the things that Diane and I were talking about, guys, is the fact that you were so much on the fringe. What was the role of, say, police or FBI in your world? I mean, were you followed? Were you tagged? Were you wiretapped because you had relationships?
Yeah, that's true. And what I would do invariably, get some phone calls out of Brooklyn, where I would meet on occasion with a rather important person in the Bonanno family, and that was Uncle John Baracci. And phone calls would come in to me, not by him, but by underlings, that they were under surveillance in Brooklyn, and that I should cool it and not come around for 4 to 6 weeks. And that happened occasionally throughout the years.
I just want to interject here.
Sure.
Steve told me that he would get a phone call, and the person on the other end of the phone was a voice he had never heard before. And they would say something like, coffee shop, 10th Avenue, 11 o'clock, and hang up. And he knew that those calls were coming from Brooklyn, from the Bonanno family, and Uncle John wanted him to be there, but they would never make the phone call themselves. They knew that they were being wiretapped or whatever.
I don't know whether you guys know the Belt Parkway in Brooklyn.
Yeah, I know.
Running through Coney Island.
Yeah.
Well, there's a plaza there called Lohman's Plaza. Well, there was. I haven't been back there for a while. I'm sure it's there. And I would be told to meet either at the McDonald's or the Burger King in the plaza for a cup of coffee. And somebody would pick me up and then take me to a plumbing shop in Brooklyn. Now, the plumbing shop was the front.
That's just like a movie scene.
Movie? We're trying to get people to support us to make a movie or a Netflix series. Maybe
definitely.
You know some people.
Hey, Diane, I want to ask you a question, and guys, listen in to my question for her, and then you can comment. So many times in court, and you're a court reporter extraordinaire, you see people who are brought in and charged with being accessories to crimes. Does this kind of story sound like anything you've seen in a court where they've either brought a guy like Steve in as a witness or they've charged a guy like Steve just because he's been in the same spot and maybe the wrong place at the wrong time?
You know, Jordan, on a small scale, but nothing like on this level, this would be a federal court situation, I think. You wouldn't see this type of a thing in my little piddling court. I'm in Superior Court.
And
I'm robberies, rapes,
right.
And murder.
So, Steve, at any time you've been threatened by a DA or anyone with being charged because of your connections?
Never.
No.
Never.
Interesting.
No. As a matter of fact, in the book, I made it very clear that I had no part, sat down with or had conversations with in anything that was nefarious or violent or anything like that.
Spoke earlier, you referred to Bonanno, the last man standing. Can you give us a status of there is no more, quote, like what happened to the three families you speak of?
Growing up, the basis for most of the families was respect and loyalty. And don't forget, most of these people who came over were immigrants originally and had a hard time making a living growing up in Brooklyn, Bronx, Queens, New York. And they had in some way had to make a living. And the way they did it was the only way they knew. But amongst them, for the most part, the two things that were the most important things with them was respect and loyalty.
And that's what I learned as a young man and continued afterwards in all my dealings with them. They never exposed me to any of the nonsense or violence or any of that that occurred. Even in some of the favors that I did after I did it, and it wasn't criminal, any of the activities. And when I came back and reported on a couple of things, because I traveled all over America, Topps Meat became the number one frozen retail hamburger in the country. And we had, my biggest account was Walmart. We did business with Safeways, Albertsons, California, Chicago, Jewel Osco, A&P, Pathmark, ShopRite, Acme, Publix, et cetera, et cetera. Mm. So in my travels, if they had a business or an investment that they weren't exactly sure about or wanted to check up on, that's when I got a phone call. And the New Orleans story was a perfect example.
The fact that in those days, during their prime, they really did operate centered in New York, but have tentacles all over the country. So that's a perfect segue to the New Orleans story. Tell us a little bit about what happened down there for you.
Yeah, sure. I was going down there to meet with a couple of supermarket heads, and I got a phone call about 4 days before to meet at Lohman's McDonald's in Brooklyn, off of Coney Island, off the Belt Parkway. And they picked me up, brought me back to the plumbing shop, and I sat down with the gentleman, Uncle John, and he asked me to do him a favor and check on an investment that was involved with crawfish netting, bringing in crawfish off a barge. And I went down to New Orleans, and I got picked up at the airport by the sheriff's department. They came and offered up transportation back to the sheriff at the time was a gentleman by the name of John Fody, who had been sheriff for many years in the New Orleans parish. And I met with him, and there was a Bonanno down there, Les Bonanno, who had left Brooklyn or was told to leave Brooklyn and situated himself down in New Orleans with the sheriff. And it was an interesting situation. Les continued to be in the gaming or vending business. He created it down there. And I met with Les and the sheriff. Then they tried to book me into, I think it was the Sonesta, Bourbon Street. I'm not quite sure. I think in the book that's what I said. Some of the things, you know, I left to memory, which had left me. So, as I got older, but when I went down there, I got picked up at night. Well, first of all, they checked me into the hotel and got me a suite, and I didn't pay.
Nice.
Yeah, and then I was picked up, and I went to a restaurant and had dinner with this gentleman. And he was the individual who was involved in the crawfish operation. And he took me to the river after dinner. It was twilight. I could still see. And he showed me the barge that the $250,000 was invested by Brooklyn into that. And the barge had barnacles and it looked like it was dilapidated and lay in the water for 5 years.
Yes.
So now I had to go back to Brooklyn with that info. I took a couple of pictures and tell the head guy over at Bonanno what I saw. And I had to show him the pictures.
Right.
So naturally they weren't too happy because they had $250,000 back in that period of time. It was quite a bit of money.
And they knew they had gotten scammed.
Yeah.
So in a sense, Steve, you were a representative just checking
right.
the story out, just checking the scene.
Right.
Yeah.
So I came back, I kind of reported over a lunch meal in Brooklyn, and walked away. And what they did was eventually own part of a restaurant that this $250,000 was invested in near a university down in New Orleans. And that's how they got their money back. I don't know what they did down there or what they were going to do, and I wasn't interested. Naturally, the story got out that they went down, and I guess they threatened the guy. And eventually, they became a partner in that restaurant and got their money back.
One thing that Steve told me about that story was that he had gotten a phone call. Can you still hear me?
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Okay. He had gotten a phone call saying, Steve, we understand you're going to New Orleans. And he said, how do you know that I'm going to New Orleans on business? I didn't tell anybody. And they said, Steve, we know everything. Which turned out to be true.
They were involved in every industry throughout New York, Jersey, Pennsylvania, Buffalo, Rochester, Chicago, New Orleans, Kansas City.
Yeah. What was it, Giuliani's regime that took them down, that started to dismantle them?
Yes. He was, in my opinion, with what I know and what I saw, he was the best mayor of any city in the entire country. There was nobody like Rudy Giuliani.
Well, he cleaned up New York and he made it safe. Could walk
he made it
and
safe and he
fabulous.
cleaned up the corruption, too. A lot of it. A lot of it.
Now it's going down the tubes again, but...
Oh, yeah.
Big time.
Crime now.
So, Steve, what's your take on, quote-unquote, organized crime today? Now, organized crime can be cartels, it can be Russian, it can be some pretty nasty characters. Not that the mafiosos weren't tough when they had to be, but do they even compare to the old days? To the
they're more violent, the cartels and the Russians. In Brooklyn, the Russians came into Brighton Beach and took over a lot of the situations there. But the Haitians come in, the Jamaicans. I mean, it was one after another, one group after another. And eventually, the younger Italians and Irish kind of stepped aside, whether they had the strength of character, if you want to call it character, or the strength of mind to fend it off. But it definitely was going downhill with the youth that came up with the people that I knew.
It's also true that many of those younger people in that generation were college educated, and the previous generation paid, and worked hard, call it what you will, to put them through school.
And drugs became a big thing,
yeah,
too, Julie.
Right,
drugs sent it into the picture. A lot of the young ones started dealing drugs, and it was a no-no with a lot of the bigger guys. And they fell in and became addicted themselves. And that's what the downfall was. The respect and loyalty had gone out the window.
Okay.
Can I ask you, I've heard that before with the mafia, like, why did they frown upon drug dealing? I'm just curious what their mindset was.
Some of them did. Some got involved.
But the ones that were against it, why were they against it? Do you know?
Well, they had other investments, and they thought drugs eventually would kill off a lot of the things that they were doing.
The famous Don Corleone Godfather scene, drugs are dirty business. Remember that? Yeah.
Dirty business.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That's why I went out in the streets, too. And we formed that vigilante committee on the west side of Manhattan.
Yeah, there's a scene in the book, Diane, you read it, of course, and where Steve is out there against these thugs and just taking them on, which is why it's got to be a movie or a TV series, just for that scene alone. Can you also tell the story about throwing the guy out the window or almost throwing the guy out the window?
Yeah, well, I wasn't going to throw him out the window.
Well, it's a great story.
My dad and I had a love-hate relationship, and I bought him out. And as we were in the process with lawyers of buying him out, he had come back and forth from Polara. I was running the business and growing it. And he was into restaurants, coffee shops, diners, cash business he liked. I was into expanding into supermarkets, large chains, a Walmart and stuff, and U.S. Foods and ARA and all the bigger companies. Anyway, I wanted to buy him out. And he had come back from Florida during the summer, and I took a week or two off. And while I was away, he had an old habit of buying a certain product called pork spleens and trying to put it in the mix because it was bloody red. But it was illegal according to the product that we had manufactured.
It was a filler, an illegal filler.
Yeah, you could not put it in. It was not an ingredient of an all-beef hamburger. So when I got back and I started checking inventories on the third, fourth, and fifth floor of our building, I came across 800 boxes, 30-pound weight. It was almost 2 tons, exactly. Excuse me, not 2 tons, 12 tons, mm-hmm. 12 tons. And I came across it in the freezer inventory, and I went downstairs, and I approached my father, and I said, why is that product in our plant, et cetera, et cetera? Well, I was trying to make some extra money. And we got into a heated argument, and I went upstairs, and I got the controller to give me the invoice on it. Thank God there was an invoice that wasn't paid. And I took the invoice, and I said, give me the phone number of the agent who sold it to us, called him up, told him that this invoice was not getting paid, and to pick up his pork spleens. He threatened me over the phone, said I'd get a visit from somebody to make sure that I paid the invoice. A day later, a piece of garbage, a thug, came in, about 6'4", weighing close to 300, and came upstairs and said to me, are you the guy who's supposed to pay this invoice? And at that point in time, right before, I had told my secretary to open up. We had these large windows up on the second floor. It was an ex-printing plant. I don't know. They had large windows. And I opened the window up there. She got scared and she ran out. I'll never forget the look on Teresa's face. And she's, oh, my God. Anyway, guy came up. He said, are you going to pay this invoice? I said, no, that invoice isn't going to get paid. As a matter of fact, you're going to send a truck to pick up the pork spleens. Otherwise, I'm going to put them out on the street to defrost. So he made a bull rush towards me. And I was kind of quick and strong at that point in time. And I grabbed him by the ass, excuse me, and by the neck or shoulder, and just pushed him towards the open window. I slammed the window down on him, and he was thrashing and all. And I said to him, you going to send that truck? And I pulled him back out, threw him on the floor. He rolled around. And he was an enforcer and a thug for the Jewish mafia. His name was Lou Wasserman, and people in New York knew of him in many industries. He was also a collector. He would go after bad debts. So it wound up that they sent the truck the next day.
I told Steve that Lou Wasserman didn't enjoy looking straight down from that window to the parking lot two stories below.
We're dealing, Diane, with one tough Jew and one freaked out Jew in this story. I can say that because I am one skinny little Jew.
Yeah. Growing up in Brooklyn as the only Jewish kid in the radius of 5 to 10 miles, going to Hebrew school with my books under my belt and 10 kids chasing me. Eventually, I had 3 fights a day.
and you managed to defend yourself. Joe, you've been a fiction writer, and I've been blessed to know you and have the honor of reading some of your books, narrating them. They're terrific. It's amazing when you start hearing Steve's stories how much they remind us of your detective stories, some of the characters that come across. You walked into a gold mine here of information.
Yeah, Steve had some great stories, and I'm honored to have had the opportunity to put them on paper. So people that buy the book and read it, I think they'll enjoy it.
We're trying to get to the next step.
Yeah.
We've got to get that movie. And by the way, do you have anybody in mind to play you, Steve? I have an actor in mind right now. This guy would be perfect. Liev Schreiber from Ray Donovan.
Right?
Exactly. Oh, I love
Ray Donovan.
Well,
Liam Neeson?
I like him too.
I've got a particular pit of skills. Anyway.
Well, we need help, Jordan.
Well,
we need help to get this to the next step.
We got to get Joe's cousin on the train for this thing to happen, I think. Go ahead, Diane.
Well, we need people to know where they can get the book. Again, the name of the book is Living on the Fringe of the Mob by Joseph P. O'Donnell, as told by E. Steven, Steven Sachs, Sachs. Where can we get this book? I know it's on Amazon because that's where I saw it.
It's on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and other national books services that are online.
Phone is open. If there's a Hollywood producer out there who wants the best story to come along in 10 years, this is the one, guys.
Yeah, right? Don't make it 10 years. I may not be around.
Ready for the taking right now, absolutely.
Well, hopefully somebody's listening. Where are we now, Jordan? And I thought last I checked, I'm in almost 40 countries.
You're in 50 by now, so it could be an international production company, absolutely.
Well, somebody's listening somewhere.
That would be great.
I just want to thank you so much on behalf of myself and Jordan. The willingness to come on and speak about this great book.
Well, thank you for having us. We had a great time as always, and it was a real pleasure. Thank you.
Before we close the courtroom door on this podcast, we remind you that All Rise with Diane Godfrey is available on all podcast platforms. We invite you to subscribe, download, rate, and review this podcast. You've been listening to All Rise with Diane Godfrey. True stories from inside the courthouse from the lady who wrote everything down. Case dismissed.
Save big money when you start your next project today at Menards. Check out our great selection of garage and utility lighting options. In stock, ready to take home today. We carry everything to help you illuminate whatever project you're working on. Shop garage and utility lighting products in store at your nearest Menards. You can also view all of our entire selection of lighting options today on Menards.com. Save big money.